African News tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The planned repatriation of M23 rebels goes awry. The Kenyan government deregisters over 500 NGOs. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. The AFP wire service is quoting a former leader of Congo's M23 rebel group as saying several members of the group were wounded when Ugandan troops tried to get them to return home. A Ugandan military spokesman says many of the rebels fled the camp at Bihanga, where they were being held awaiting repatriation. The rebels had fled the Democratic Republic of Congo into Uganda and Rwanda after their 18-month war was ended a year ago by Congolese troops and UN peacekeepers. They signed papers vowing not to fight again in return for a possible amnesty. They were supposed to be flown back today to the DRC, but a spokesman says many M23 members are afraid to return to Congo without a stronger government guarantee of protection. The AFP reports that the Kenyan government has closed more than 500 non-governmental organizations as part of a security crackdown. 15 of the organizations have been accused of engaging in fundraising activities for terrorism. Kenya's NGO Coordination Board said the organizations had lost their registration for non-compliance with the law. Several are Christian organizations, orphanages, or groups working in the areas of health and development. The effect of the action is to freeze the NGO's bank accounts and pass information about them to security organizations for further action. Reuters reports that the government of France will help coordinate a regional effort to counter Nigeria's Boko Haram Islamist group. That announcement was made today by France's defense minister amid growing distrust among governments in the region. This is VOA News. Reuters reports that 13 people have been released from Ebola quarantine in Mali. They are the last remaining people in the country to have been isolated to stem the spread of the deadly disease. Mali could be declared free of Ebola next month if no further cases are recorded. The Associated Press reports Sierra Leone will be conducting house-to-house searches looking for hidden Ebola cases. The searches are to take place beginning Wednesday in the capital Freetown and surrounding areas. The government hopes to stop the spread of the disease. AFP reports that the capital of Guinea will ban public Christmas and New Year's celebrations this year to stem the spread of Ebola. Conakry follows the example of Sierra Leone, which also is foregoing holiday celebrations this year. A spokesman for a Libyan militia allied with the country's non-recognized parliament said today his forces will continue their efforts to take over eastern oil ports but will try not to harm the facilities. Oil operations in Es Sider and Ras Ranuf shut down Saturday when the militia positioned itself to attack the cities. Libya's internationally recognized government says it is still in control of the towns. The deadly siege by Taliban militants at a school in Pakistan has ended, leaving at least 141 people dead, most of them children. Islamist militants wearing military uniforms and strapped with explosives attacked the military-run school in Peshawar. An army spokesman said the security forces killed six of the attackers. The spokesman told a news conference in Peshawar that security forces killed the seven attackers. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the massacre. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke in London.
This act of terror angers and shakes all people of conscience, and we condemn it in the strongest terms possible.
John Kerry. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has described the hostage taking at a Sydney cafe as the sick fantasy of a disturbed individual. Prime Minister Abbott today joined Australians in mourning the victims of the siege, which ended when police conducted a raid to free the hostages. Two car bombs exploded today south of the Yemeni capital. They hit a school bus that was traveling near a Shiite rebel gathering. 25 people were killed, including 15 students. The Reuters news agency quotes Iranian chief nuclear negotiator and deputy foreign minister Abbas Araghchi as saying bilateral talks between Iranian and American officials proceeded today in a good atmosphere. He said, however, there are still disagreements on some key issues relating to his government's nuclear program. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya has withdrawn recognition of about 500 non-governmental organizations working in the country, some for alleged link to terrorism. The decision comes as Kenya seeks to tighten security following recent attacks blamed on Islamist militants. The crackdown on NGOs may also be related to their relationships with the International Criminal Court and cases against Kenya's president and his deputy.
That's Mohammed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, a British man has been found guilty on charges of sexually abusing street children in Kenya. Human Rights Watch reports at least 184 civilians have been massacred by rebels in the eastern DRC since October. And the UN Children's Fund reports that 2014 has been the worst year ever for children caught in conflict. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Kenya has withdrawn recognition of about 500 non-governmental organizations working in the country, some for alleged links to terrorism. The decision comes as Kenya seeks to tighten security following recent attacks blamed on Islamist militants. The crackdown on NGOs may also be related to their relationship with the International Criminal Court and cases against Kenya's president and his deputy. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenya's non-governmental organization coordination board has accused 15 organizations of financing terror and criminal activities in the country and in the Horn of Africa. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, the board's executive director, Fazul Mohamed, says bank accounts of some 500 civil society groups have been frozen, permits of foreign workers revoked, and some face possible prosecution.
In collaboration with security agencies, both locally and internationally, the board has identified these NGOs, their collaborators, sources of funding, and their activities. The board has, with immediate effect, deregistered these organizations, frozen their bank accounts, and forwarded information on them to the relevant government security agencies for appropriate action.
Mohammed says the coordination board will be distributing the frozen money to other NGOs that have permission to operate in the country.
We have frozen their bank accounts immediately, and we are now in the process of repossessing their assets with a view of redistributing the same to other NGOs pursuing similar charitable objectives.
Last year, Kenyan lawmakers introduced a bill which sought to restrict the amount of funding NGOs can get from foreign sources to just 15%. In the last few months, many NGOs in Kenya have found themselves under increased scrutiny due to an uneasy relationship with the government over the cases at the International Criminal Court in The Hague involving Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto. The two men face charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly helping orchestrate post-election violence 7 years ago that left more than 1,000 Kenyans dead. The frosty relationship between Kenya's government and civil society organizations was on display last week at a New York meeting of the Assembly of State Parties, which is the management oversight and legislative body for the ICC. The group Kenyans for Peace with Truth and Justice circulated a flyer titled Kenya's Seven-Step Formula for Impunity. Kenya media reports the behavior of some of NGOs, including KPTJ, angered the government officials and Council of Elders representatives present at the meeting. Politicians allied to President Kenyatta and his deputy have accused some lobbying groups of colluding with the ICC to persuade witnesses to testify against Mr. Kenyatta and Ruto. Earlier this month, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda dropped the charges against Mr. Kenyatta, citing a lack of evidence and lack of cooperation from the Kenyan government to provide key documents to the prosecution. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohammed. A British man has been found guilty on charges of sexually abusing street children in Kenya. A jury in Birmingham, England, found 55-year-old Simon Harris guilty of 5 sexually assault charges. Harris was cleared of 7 other charges, including rape. Witnesses in Kenya gave live video testimony during the trial. Harris had been accused of luring street children as young as 7 years old to his home in Gilgil, Kenya. That's where he ran a charity for homeless children in the 1990s called The Greenhouse. Harris had come under suspicion when a film crew working on a documentary about Kenya street children heard rumors of Harris's activities. And rebels have massacred at least 184 civilians in the eastern DRC since October, according to Human Rights Watch. VOA's Gabe Joslin reports the violence has been attributed to a rebel movement operating in the area despite UN and Congolese army operations against the group.
In research published Tuesday, Human Rights Watch documented horrifying brutality in the Beni territory of eastern DRC, where witnesses say rebels have been hacking civilians to death with machetes and axes and shooting others with firearms during attacks on villages. In one of the worst instances, local groups say at least 50 people were killed in one night in mid-November. The attacks are believed to have been carried out by the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, an Islamist group that began its rebellion in neighboring Uganda in the mid-1990s. Human Rights Watch senior researcher Ida Sawyer says the violence appears aimed primarily at spreading terror.
The attackers have come in. Sometimes they pretend to be Congolese army soldiers, and they come into the community and act like they're there to protect the civilians. And then later on, when night falls, they turn against the population and start hacking them to death.
Sawyer said Human Rights Watch could only confirm 184 people killed in attacks between October and December of this year, but said the actual number is likely significantly higher. She notes the attacks are more brutal than usually carried out by ADF, and the assailants are speaking languages not usually spoken by the group, indicating that other armed groups may also be involved.
What we do know is that these attacks are horrifically vicious, and the population living there is terrorized and don't know where to turn for protection.
Congolese armed forces, backed by UN peacekeepers, have been battling the ADF since January and have driven the rebels from their main bases in eastern DRC. The head of the UN peacekeeping force, MONUSCO, Martin Kobler, tells VOA about 1,200 UN peacekeepers, including Tanzanian soldiers, are working alongside 8,000 Congolese troops. He says there are many challenges opposing a group using guerrilla tactics in difficult terrain.
It's a huge area with jungles, and even if the enemy is 7 kilometers away, I mean, if you have to walk 7 kilometers, this takes 1.5 hours or 2 hours until you reach the place. And neither the FARDC, the Congolese Army, nor MONUSCO can really be everywhere.
In 2013, the Congolese Army and UN peacekeepers successfully defeated the M23 rebel movement in eastern Congo, while the ADF has proven harder to pin down. Kobler says to improve the time it takes for peacekeepers and soldiers to respond to violence, MONUSCO has set up a hotline for civilians in Beni to report threats and information on rebel groups. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Gabe. DRC President Joseph Kabila has warned foreign powers not to meddle in his country's electoral politics. French President François Hollande recently advised Africa's heads of state not to change constitutions to run a third time for president. U.S. officials offered similar cautions to Mr. Kabila and other heads of state. Mr. Kabila has not yet said publicly whether he wants a third term in 2016. Opposition parties have protested against such a decision. In other news, more than 1,500 Congolese ex-rebels have fled from a camp in Uganda to avoid being returned to DRC. The leader of a large group of disarmed M23 fighters escaped from their quarters at a Uganda military camp. DRC officials have met with Uganda authorities and were expected today to begin escorting the former fighters home for reintegration. More than 20,000 civilians in DRC were displaced by a 20-month M23 rebellion. 14 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Sierra Leone's Ebola infection rates continue to climb due to flare-ups in the capital, Freetown, and the country's more heavily populated western areas. Despite that bad news, the head of the World Health Organization's Ebola mission in West Africa says Sierra Leone is well placed to contain the disease with infrastructure, organization, and aid. Dr. Bruce Aylward says Sierra Leone may need a big shock that could change people's behavior. Sierra Leone Health Minister Abubakar Fofana says the government is considering banning some unsafe practices, but he wasn't sure how they could enforce such laws. The UN Children's Fund reports that 2014 has been the worst year ever for children caught in conflict. UNICEF estimates 230 million children live in countries and areas affected by armed conflict, with 15 million children caught up in six of the most violent: the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, the State of Palestine, Syria, and Ukraine. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund describes 2014 as a year of horror, fear, and despair for millions of children caught in conflicts of extreme violence. UNICEF Crisis Communications Chief Sarah Crowe says children have been forcibly recruited as soldiers, sold as sex slaves, and deliberately targeted by warring groups.
If this was a report card for the world, we would have failed outright. It's been an appalling, devastating year for children, and children have been put in harm's way like never before. Never in recent history have we seen so many children directly impacted by conflict, by war, by violence. 15 million directly and 230 million indirectly, meaning in chronic low conflict zones, war zones. The numbers are truly numbing.
UNICEF says the horrors to which children are exposed know no bounds. It says children have been killed while studying in the classroom and while sleeping in their beds. They have been orphaned, kidnapped, and tortured. The agency says the eruption of civil wars in the Central African Republic and in South Sudan 1 year ago has plunged millions of children into despair, exposing them to unaccountable dangers. It says fighting in these countries has forced hundreds of thousands of children to flee their homes. It says many have been killed and maimed, and tens of thousands of children are suffering from severe malnutrition and outbreaks of disease. UNICEF reports wars in the Middle East are taking a heavy toll, especially upon women and children. It notes last summer's 50-day conflict in Gaza killed 538 children and left 54,000 homeless. It reports women and girls in Iraq are sexually assaulted, sold into slavery, and trafficked. It says many of the more than 7.3 million children affected by conflict in Syria have been killed and maimed. It adds children in both countries have increasingly become victims of brutal and extreme violence. Since the Russian-supported rebellion in Ukraine began in April, UNICEF reports more than 100,000 children have become displaced. It adds the number of children killed and wounded is rising. In addition to these conflicts, UNICEF spokeswoman Crowe tells VOA children this year are faced with significant new health threats. She says the Ebola outbreak in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone has left thousands of children orphaned and an estimated 5 million out of school.
Never before have we seen a public health emergency that has affected children, their health, their livelihoods, their parents' livelihoods, their education, every aspect of their world, meaning Ebola.
Despite the tremendous challenges, UNICEF says there is hope for millions of children affected by conflict. It notes United Nations and private aid agencies throughout the year have been providing life-saving assistance and other critical services, such as education and emotional support to help traumatized children survive their desperate situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Governments failed to come to a breakthrough agreement at last week's climate summit in Peru, but a South African mega brewer sent delegates to the talks and says it is one of many private companies taking their own steps to fight climate change. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
At this year's climate change conference in Peru, the 194 nations present failed to meet a firm agreement to cut carbon emissions. They will meet again next year in Paris in hopes of hammering out a concrete agreement. But this year at the conference, more private industry giants said they have a large role to play in pushing for improvement, and major industry creates the bulk of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. The world's second largest beer brewer, SAB Miller, which was founded in South Africa but is now based in Britain, sent delegates to this year's climate change conference as part of a strategy to partner with governments to better care for the environment. Vice President for Corporate Affairs for SAB Miller Peru, Felipe Cantuarias, says any climate change discussions need to include input from major industry. He spoke to VOA News via Skype from Lima, Peru.
All these issues are not going to be resolved just by one government, by NGOs or multilateral agencies working alone. I think the main request by everybody at the meeting was this has to be addressed as a partnership working all together.
But he acknowledged that not all businesses have the same environmental interests. His company, which is also the largest Coca-Cola bottler in Africa, has a particular focus, and with annual revenues of more than $23 billion, a lot is at stake.
One of the main challenges we are facing right now is water, water scarcity. So that becomes part of our strategy. The same with food security. All along our value chain, food security becomes a challenge for our business and also for our communities.
He cited projects in sub-Saharan Africa that aim at improving these issues, such as a project in Uganda to grow sorghum to make beer, reducing the need to import ingredients. He said while this year's climate agreement is far from perfect, progress is being made.
And I will say in the COP20 in Peru, even though there have been some criticism about the lack of aggressive agreements, I will say that we have made progress. I think we have moved forward some important basic agreements that are critical to really start seeing some progress around issues like food security and water security.
But ultimately, he said, the fight against climate change does not rest on one government, one company, or one person, but on everyone. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Kampala Capital City Authority and the Ministry of Works and Transport have been attempting to reform Kampala's motorcycle taxi service, known locally as Boda Bodas, for years. While implementing change has proven difficult, they have received an unexpected boost from the private sector. Elizabeth Pula has more from Kampala.
When it comes to regulating the chaotic streets of Kampala, police officers and government officials have their work cut out for them. Nearly 80,000 bodas weave in and out of Kampala's congested streets every day. Police officers say they regularly feel overwhelmed. The KCCA instituted a number of reforms to equip boda drivers with helmets, registration numbers, and uniforms. However, they are coming up against boda associations, and disagreements over fees and obligations have led to delays. Yet the government is finding help in the private sector with the advent of the Safe Boda Organization. It aims to provide safe, reliable service while cutting down on injuries. Drivers are equipped with helmets for themselves and passengers, first aid training provided by the Red Cross, basic boda maintenance, and a traffic course taught by police. Ricky Thompson, one of the founders and a longtime boda driver, explains the necessity for privatized safety measures.
Lots of people are getting involved into the road accidents because the bodas that we already found, they don't go to driving schools. They just bought their bodas and started doing the business. So they have no idea how the road looks like and what they are supposed to take care of when they are on the road. So basically the police comes in to tell them and what they're going to face on the street. These are some of the mechanisms we use to build a strong community.
Boda accidents are so common that in Malago, a major hospital in Kampala, 60% of the budget is used to treat boda accidents. Of those who enter the hospital with a head injury from a boda accident, 50% die. Making safe transport marketable might have the impact needed to regulate the industry. Boda drivers often face a stigma of being untrustworthy and dangerous. By giving drivers emblazoned vests and bright helmets, safe boda drivers are seen as an elite class of drivers. Alistair Sussuk, another co-founder at Safe Boda, explains how fighting the stigma can also ease unemployment.
The border industry is very much a result of lack of employment opportunities for 18 to 35-year-olds in Uganda. It's a great job because it provides cash flow every single day. So the border industry represents a pretty good job opportunity for young men, and that's very important. But still, it comes with a stigma of being an unworthy job. And we're obviously trying to change that.
The KCCA and Ministry of Transport say they welcome private sector development and hope that a focus on safety will drive down healthcare costs while paving the way for future reforms. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
While most women begin their menstrual cycles at around the age of 13, a new study suggested that those who start menstruating a few years before or after that average age appear to be at increased risk of heart disease and stroke. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The study by researchers at Oxford University in Britain analyzed data collected from 1.3 million mostly white women, ages 50 to 64. They noticed a pattern among women who had their first menstrual cycle at age 10 or younger, or 17 or older. During the more than 10 years the women were followed, those two groups had a 27% increased risk of hospitalizations or death due to heart disease. There were 16% more hospitalizations or deaths from stroke among those groups, and high blood pressure led to a 20% increased likelihood of hospitalizations or related deaths. Dexter Canoy, the study's lead author, is a cardiovascular epidemiologist at the University of Oxford's Cancer Epidemiology Unit within the Department of Population Health. He says there's a strong association between the age of menarche, when a woman's first period occurs, and heart disease and stroke risk. If plotted on a chart, he says it would look like the letter U, with the highest risk of cardiovascular disease among those who started menstruating at a young age at one tip of the U, and those who began later on in their teens at the other. Women who begin menstruating around age 13, which is typical, were seen to be at the lowest risk, according to Canoy, at the bottom of the U.
Whether or not you're lean, overweight, or obese, we found the same U-shape association. And even if we take into account, let's say, whether or not you're taking medications for high blood pressure or high cholesterol or even having diabetes, it seems that our result is robust.
Canoy does see a link between menarche and weight. Obese girls tend to start menstruating at a younger age. They also often become obese adults, which is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Canoy says it may be possible to lower the risk of heart disease and stroke in women by fighting obesity in children, which might also increase the age at which girls start to menstruate.
Children who are obese can develop heart disease in the long run, but one aspect that can be potentially be prevented is through the mechanism that might involve early onset of menstruation.
Canoy says late-onset menstruation has historically been linked to malnutrition. An article on the link between age and menarche and cardiovascular disease is published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenya withdraws recognition of 500 non-governmental organizations working in the country. Human Rights Watch reports at least 184 civilians in the eastern DRC have been massacred. And the UN Children's Fund reports that 2014 has been the worst year ever for children caught in conflict. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off today with international club football.
Big tournament taking place this evening in Morocco, Kim. And joining us once again on the Voice of America from Johannesburg to tell us about it is our African football guru, David Legg. Seasonal sporty greetings, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, let's kick off in Marrakesh, Morocco. We're at 19:30 hours GMT on Tuesday evening, the first semifinal at the FIFA Club World Cup. European champion Real Madrid will meet Cruz Azul of Mexico. The second semifinal on Wednesday evening between San Lorenzo of Argentina and Auckland City of New Zealand. Now, David, our VOA football fans might be interested. I guess Auckland City pretty much did a number on the African teams.
Yes, Sonny, that's not a fixture I think any of us in Africa envisaged. We thought it might be Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco or Anton Satif of Algeria, but definitely not Auckland City of New Zealand. And I say that with the greatest of respect to the Oceania champions. Sonny, they've been in just about every edition of the FIFA Club World Cup. What's equally consistent about them is they tend to go out very early. Normally they go out in at the playoff stage. They don't even make it to the quarterfinals. But they have not only shocked Tetouan, but they've also shocked Satif. I watched the Tetouan Auckland City game, and Sonny, it's hard to describe just how bad the Moroccans were. Dismal, diabolical, awful. They were shocking. I saw some shots at goal that truly would have embarrassed an eight-year-old learning the skills of football or soccer.
Mm.
The Moroccans had absolutely nothing to offer, no creativity. And when they did get a sight of goal, they ballooned the ball into the stands. Really, really poor performance, especially when you consider that last year, the Moroccan team in the competition, Raja Casablanca, did superbly. They got all the way to the final. Ironically, their very first victims were Auckland City. And in the final, they put up a good show before losing to Bayern Munich. And I think on that basis alone, I think everybody else in Africa who follows football expected much better from Maghreb Tetouan. I mean, after all, the Moroccan League, which they won this year, is among the most competitive on the continent. It's 16 clubs. It's fully professional, and it was truly, truly embarrassing. Auckland City, they were well organized. They had good team spirit, but really a good African club should have beaten them by two or three goals. Anyway, no goals after 90 minutes, still no goals after 30 minutes of extra time. It went to penalties. Each side missed one in the early stages of the shootout, but the New Zealanders converted their fifth and final mandatory penalty. So they had a 4-3 lead. Up stepped the Moroccan player, and he needed to score to take it to sudden death, but he crashed his shot against the woodwork. It rebounded into play. And that was it, Sonny, 4-3 on penalties to Auckland City. My immediate feeling was, well, Satifa watched this game. They are, after all, the African champions. They've had a good look now at Auckland City, and surely they won't make any mistakes. Well, I was sadly mistaken. I was badly misjudging the situation. Because this time, Auckland City decided we don't need a penalty shootout. We're going to win this match in regular time. And that's exactly what they did. A goal from John Irving after 52 minutes was enough to beat a Satif side that really were almost as bad as Maghreb Tetouan. And you've got to ask yourself, Sonny, what on earth went wrong? Because the conditions could not have been more favorable. Here we have two North African teams playing their matches in North Africa against a club from New Zealand. That's a long, far distance away. I, and I believe everybody else in Africa, confidently expected we would have Tetouan against Satif for a place in the semi-finals. But you read out the fixtures, and they are the sad facts. We have the semi-finals, and we have no sight of an African club. Very disappointing indeed.
David, as I look at that San Lorenzo-Auckland City semi-final on Wednesday, I think it's safe to say San Lorenzo will have a higher power backing it in Pope Francis.
That's right, Sonny. He's Argentinian, of course, by birth, and he's a big football fan. And I really can't believe that Auckland City can do it again. I mean, Auckland City in the final? Surely not. Sonny, it looks like it's dangerous to make predictions in this tournament because we've had shock after shock so far. But I'm pretty confident it's going to be Real Madrid of Spain against San Lorenzo of Argentina. That should be a cracker of a final. Cruz Azul of Mexico against Auckland City of New Zealand? I'm not so sure about the pulling power of that one, Sonny.
David, let's turn our attention now to Europe. VOA! Can you give our VOA football fans a look at some recent African goal scorers?
Yes, Sonny, unfortunately not too many. In fact, just one in the English Premier League, and it's a name that seems to be very common when it comes to the sunny side of sport. It's Wilfred Bonny. He's the Ivorian striker, big, burly man who plays for Swansea, and he scored in their home match against Tottenham, but unfortunately it wasn't enough. Tottenham winning the match by 2-1, a very late winner indeed, Eriksen. Scoring with just 1 minute left. And unfortunately, that was the only African goal in the English Premier League. And then if we turn to Spain, fortunately, some African scorers there. El Arabi, the Moroccan, he scored for Granada. But again, it wasn't enough. Like Bonny, his team suffered a 2-1 defeat. In this case, it was Espanyol who beat Granada by 2-1. And Feghouli, the Algerian, he was in fine form for Valencia. Valencia beating Rayo Vallecano by 3-0. And the first two goals, both in the first half, came from the Algerian wide midfield player. And he's, of course, one of the stars of the Algerian side who will be among the favorites for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. And sadly, Sonny, that's about it. So it was Bonny, El Arabi and Feghouli. They were the African scorers in the major European leagues.
Thanks for that update, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And David will be back on the sunny side of sports later this week with more Soccerlicious analysis.
This is Magnus Chisholm calling from Imo State in Nigeria. I love listening to the sunny side of sports. It's always a daily delight of listening to the sunny side of sports. Once again, Magnus Chisholm and we are calling from Imo State in Nigeria and wishing all the sunny side of sports listeners all the best.
And all the best to you, Magnus, during this holiday season. Magnus Chisholm Onwadiwe, a.k.a. the humble apostle of the sunny side of sports, has been a devoted disciple of the show, and he gets top billing in my latest blog post, which you can check out via the following internet address,
blogs.voanews.com. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com. The title of the blog post is The Humble Apostle and Sporty Holiday Reflections. And you can read about a few of my holiday reflections during this festive season.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America, they're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In National Basketball Association action Monday night, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers got off to a very fast start and beat the visiting Charlotte Hornets 97-88. The host Cavaliers jumped to a 21-0 lead to start the game, but the Hornets regrouped and got within 2 points early in the third quarter before the Cavaliers pulled away. LeBron once again led the way for Cleveland. He scored 27 points and also passed for 13 assists. Kevin Love added 22 points and 18 rebounds for the Cavaliers, who improved their record to 14 wins and 9 losses. The Hornets now have a record of 6 victories and 18 defeats. And this reminder for our VOA basketball fans, Charlotte is the club owned by NBA great Michael Jordan. MJ still has a lot of work to do with the Hornets. Elsewhere around the NBA, a couple of games went right down to the final buzzer. The Atlanta Hawks beat the Chicago Bulls 93-86. Al Horford scored 21 points for the Hawks, including a big jump shot with just under a minute remaining. The Hawks have been flying high recently. They have a record of 17 wins and 7 losses. In another action, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Phoenix Suns 96-94. Chris Middleton nailed a buzzer-beating 3-point shot as Milwaukee slipped by Phoenix on the road. The Bucks improved to 13 wins and 12 losses. And another score from the NBA, the Indiana Pacers defeated the Los Angeles Lakers 110-91. Rodney Stuckey got his second consecutive double-double. That's double figures in two categories. Rodney had 20 points and grabbed 10 rebounds to lead Indiana. Kobe Bryant led all the scorers. He had 21 points in another losing effort. Tough year for the Lakers. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, health officials in South Sudan say the fight against AIDS has become more challenging because of the ongoing conflict. And humanitarian workers train in Brussels on how to help Ebola victims and protect themselves from the virus. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Tosin of Nigeria with a live version of Resolve to Love.
Yeah,
told me sweet lies. Oh, here you are again. You left me hanging on my own. Here you are. Oh, hey. You just told me sweet lies. Yeah, yeah. Oh, here you are again. You left me hanging on my own. Tell me, how can we stay on and on this way? Tell me, how can we open a new chapter in our world? Yeah, we've got to resolve, resolve. We've got to resolve to love, yeah. We've got to resolve. Leave the past behind.
Tosin of Nigeria with a live version of Resolve to Love. Well, health officials in South Sudan say the fight against AIDS has become more challenging because of the ongoing conflict. Officials fear the difficulty of controlling the spread of the disease among so many people displaced by a year of fighting. Mugumi Davis Rakawiri has more.
Dr. Emmanuel Lino, the former director in charge of AIDS activities at the National Minister of Health in Juba, says it is very difficult to stop the spread of AIDS, particularly among young people living in IDP camps.
Experiences have shown also when people are staying together, like in confinement, for a long period, as we have been hearing, even during this conflict of ours, you'll find that young people are idle, 24 hours in one place, so you'll find them getting to play like these smaller games which bring young people together, but then they can now think of other things, criminal activities if available, sexual practice, because we know that HIV in our countries mainly goes through sexual intercourse.
Lino says another problem people undergoing AIDS treatment face is they cannot easily access health facilities because of the ongoing conflict. Nearly all of the facilities in Upper Nile, Unity and Jonglei State were destroyed by fighters during the early stages of the conflict.
There are those who would have been, you know, consistently receiving their treatment. Sometimes they might have been displaced somewhere where completely they don't have any contacts with healthcare services.
About 2 million people have been displaced by nearly year-long conflict, and more than 500,000 have fled outside the country. Lino says minister officials assess damage in those three states because it's still too dangerous in many areas. But he says his ministry is working with humanitarian agencies in the country to help those in need of HIV AIDS services.
Some of them may not have the facilities to provide treatment. So we tell them, okay, if you are having health workers there and there are people who are in need of treatment, then come to us, we can provide.
Health officials say more than 9,400 people out of more than 16,000 people in need are receiving treatment for HIV/AIDS in South Sudan. Lino says there are simply not enough resources to fight the AIDS epidemic in South Sudan.
During such hard times, other priorities are more important than others. Even if someone looks at food, for them is the most important thing. Clean water could be the most important. Some, you know, hygiene and safe environment could be a priority.
The U.S. Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, is stepping in. Through the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, PEPFAR is providing $18 million U.S. to scale up HIV prevention treatment and to help those in need of antiretroviral or ARVs. The funds will be used to build laboratory capacity, support orphans and other vulnerable children, and strengthen disease surveillance system. For VOA News, I am Mugume Dev Sirwakarinj.
The International Staff of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, is praised for its swift and effective response to the Ebola outbreak in the hardest-hit countries Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. MSF also plays a vital role in Europe, thousands of miles from the epidemic, at three training centers where they teach humanitarian workers how to help Ebola victims and protect themselves from the virus that has killed almost 7,000 people this year. Lisa Bryant visited an Ebola training center in Brussels.
So now it's time for the gown. So normally you have a mirror in your dressing area, where first of all you will have to tear open the different straps.
By now, many of us recognize the yellow spacesuit-like outfit of an Ebola worker. But try putting one on. Add a rubber apron and two pairs of gloves. Also the white hood, the goggles, and the boots. I'm watching about a dozen people struggle with what experts call personal protective equipment, or PPE.
You can see your orange mask. From here, many prefer that the green part covered totally.
Even a centimeter of exposed skin can mean death for anybody in close contact with Ebola victims. That's the danger facing this group of doctors, nurses, hygienists, and logisticians. But we're a long way from the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak in steamy West Africa. We're in a tent pitched in a vast muddy lot in Brussels. The wintry skyline is edged with factories run by Doctors Without Borders, or MSF as it's called here. This is a sort of boot camp 101 for hundreds of humanitarian workers joining the fight against the deadly virus.
It's like a preparatory training, really. We make sure that they understand what Ebola is. And, of course, how they can stay safe and how they can keep other people safe. And, of course, understand the overall response to an Ebola outbreak, so they know that it requires teamwork at all levels, from day-to-day work in a centre to the whole coordinated response. Without any of those parts, we won't win in this outbreak.
It is really to have everything behind you.
All right.
Okay?
That's behind me, miss.
Nearby you, okay. Sorry.
Nurse Brett Adamson facilitates the Ebola training sessions that started here in August. Those attending the workshops include not only MSF staff, but also government employees and humanitarian workers from other agencies. MSF recently opened two other training centers in Switzerland and the Netherlands to handle the growing demand.
You have to be the more comfortable, so you can take your time.
There is nobody around here.
There is nobody.
Besides lessons on wearing protective gear, trainees also learn how to safely take blood and remove the soiled bedclothes of Ebola patients who may have vomited or had diarrhea. The tent is equipped like a real hospital, with rooms set out for suspect and confirmed cases. There's even an area marked morgue for the many who don't survive. MSF trainer Matthias Kennis explains the different zones of a typical Ebola treatment center.
In high-risk zone, we have all patients, actually. We make the difference between the suspect zone, so that's the zone where we have patients that just arrived and who need to be confirmed by laboratory tests. In high-risk zone, we have only confirmed patients. So these people, they stay inside until they are cured. But a lot of people, they don't cure, so they die.
The bag is dirty. We need to disinfect it from the outside.
Fighting Ebola means protecting yourself first. For Adi Nadimpali, a physician from New Orleans, it's almost counterintuitive. He's just spent 3 months heading a trauma hospital in war-torn Central African Republic.
Like, I'm used to, if I see a person with a gunshot wound, go right away, touch, put my gloves on, stethoscope on, feel what's going on. And here, no, get your suit on, make sure that it's okay, make sure that you're not at risk, you're not putting anybody else at risk.
So there's no treatment? Are we concerned about creating drugs?
Ebola is also exacting a profound psychological toll, both for patients and those who care for them. MSF staff who have been on the front lines describe the frustrations of battling the virus, the lack of any proven treatment, the high fatality rate, the difficulty of physically reaching out and comforting suffering patients, and the sheer volume of need. Workshop facilitator Brett Adamson.
You feel compromised in what you're doing, and you question yourself, and you always feel like you need to be doing more. But you're bound by, well, these limitations. I know a lot of us, the first time we went into some of those Ebola management centres, you were crying while going around, particularly the first couple of times.
At some point, the outbreak will be contained. The humanitarian community will turn to other crises. But for Ebola survivors, the story won't be over, says MSF psychologist Anna Bjuro-Finzata.
Anyone who survives, they've lost someone. They come back to big questions and empty houses and neighbors who cross the road when they see them. Even when we've had the last person either recovering or dying, there's still a lot of work to be done.
So in Brussels and in West Africa, the war against Ebola is far from over and tougher than ever. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Brussels.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the three decades since HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, was identified. Even as recently as a decade ago, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS seemed like a death sentence for an entire continent, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Back then, more than 2 million people died from AIDS-related causes on a worldwide basis. Today, we've cut those numbers by 34%. Back then, AIDS threatened to wipe out a whole generation, leaving behind 14 million orphans and vulnerable children. Today, we've slashed new infections among children in half. The tide has turned, said Secretary Kerry. We are fighting the disease, and an AIDS-free generation is in sight.
PEPFAR is now supporting life-saving antiretroviral drug treatment for 7.7 million men, women, and children. We're providing HIV testing and counseling to more than 14 million pregnant women. We're training more than 140,000 new healthcare workers to deliver HIV and other health-related services in AIDS-affected countries.
But the battle is not yet won, said Secretary Kerry. So the United States is intensifying the fight against this terrible disease and introducing new strategies. First, PEPFAR is collaborating with the Nike Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in a $210 million public-private partnership to achieve an AIDS-free future for adolescent girls and young women in up to 10 countries. Second, we will invest $116.5 million to strengthen the capacity of health workers to deliver life-saving HIV services and also help address other public health threats across Africa. Third, through the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment Initiative, PEPFAR, and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, over the next 2 years, we will double the total number of children receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment across 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We are also working with our partners to accelerate the development of new pediatric medicines. Fourth, PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are partnering to invest $21.5 million toward creating country-driven local data hubs that will include data critical to controlling the epidemic, including health, poverty, and gender data, and will be used to improve strategic planning and quality of care. The United States' commitment to combating HIV/AIDS through PEPFAR and our long-standing support of the Global Fund is as undiminished as our work is unfinished. We can achieve an AIDS-free generation, said Secretary Kerry. We can and we will defeat this horrific disease.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Lenor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.